Group meeting, Friday, 21st June, 1985. Immediately, the question arises, can the heart of religion be communicated through the medium of thought or speech? As long as we are self-conscious, we are as opaque matter obstructing the light. When we are reduced to our nothingness, the transcendent is there. Now we must be very careful not to misunderstand this sentence, these two sentences. As long as we are self-conscious, as psychophysical organisms, the person living in the world, we have to be self-conscious. Otherwise we couldn't cross the street without danger. But the trouble is that our self-consciousness is an isolative and a separative self-consciousness. So we are conscious in terms of self, I, me, mine, and so on, and the not-self, not me, not mine, you see. So there is a fundamental dualism absolutely rooted in the limitation which characterizes our consciousness. And it is this dualism which is the milieu in which conflict can take place. Because in the isolatively self-conscious organism, there arises desire and so forth. And that desire is all too often in conflict with another person's desire and so forth, you see. So, whilst we are self-conscious, we obstruct the light of transcendence from functioning through us. It is not the self-consciousness which we have to get rid of, but we have to transform it into a consciousness which accepts the totality, which takes the whole into account, you see. And then it has ceased to be isolative and separative. It is the isolativeness and the separativeness which must disappear, you see. And it is very difficult to realize that state of consciousness. Because remember, consciousness is not an organ like the heart or the liver or the eye or the ear or something. It's not an organ, you see. The psychophysical organism possesses various avenues which we call the senses, through which impressions travel to our brain, and our brain is taught to interpret those impressions, you see. And since every brain is different, really considerably different from every other brain, and it is conditioned in a different way, therefore the interpretation is faulty. We have to bear this in mind. Our interpretation is faulty and it is extremely limited. But by living the holy life, that's to say, nothing other than the secular life lived virtuously. That is the meaning of living the religious life. To live the everyday life virtuously, that is all. And that has an influence on our mind as such. And consciousness, and we become conscious. Remember, in the first instance, we are conscious in the separative, isolative way which leads to conflict and misery and sorrow and trouble and all the rest of it. Now we become conscious in a different way. Consciousness is not an organ which undergoes a change. It's not like a muscle which you can develop and make stronger. It's not like that. We can be conscious. We are conscious through the functioning of the whole organism, through the senses and the activity of the brain. You see? But by living the holy life, we become conscious of that same reality around us and in ourselves in a different manner. In a manner which is inclusive, which makes for harmony, which makes for wisdom and the expression of all the great spiritual values. That is the difference, you see. So there is no goal to aim at, actually. Live the virtuous life, and this change will inevitably take place. It is a mistake to define the goal. We say kingdom of heaven, we say nirvana, and all that sort of stuff and nonsense. You see? But how can the imperfect mind, the imperfect brain, picture or describe or express in thought and word that which is utterly transcendent? It can't do it. Just live the life, and that change in consciousness will take place. You know how often I have used the phrase, the lightning flash of transcendence. When that lightning of transcendence strikes you, everything suddenly is utterly changed. You see? It's like that. And then you discover that our ordinary instruments of expression in thought and speech are totally inadequate. And yet you will be conscious in terms of the infinite and the eternal. See? So, when we are reduced to our nothingness, that is to say, we as we are at present and the way we are conscious, when we realize that this self which we assert, I am, I want, etc., etc., has calmed down completely. It's not that the self is destroyed, far from it. The self is actually glorified. You remember how in St. John's Gospel, Jesus, that marvelous prayer from chapter 14 onwards, it's one of the most wonderful things in all religious literature. He says, "Now, O Father, glorify me with the glory which I had with thee before the world was." You see? What does that mean? There isn't a separate Jesus who was one with a chap called the Father. It is that transcendent totality, that absoluteness, you see, which expressing itself, which putting itself into manifestation, brought about separation. And division and so forth, you see, and conflict and all the rest of it. So when Jesus says, before the world was, it means before there was manifestation, there was only the absolute all, the totality, God, if you like. And so what happens is that transcendence which is embodied here and now in every one of us, you see, is once more unrestricted, unconstricted by manifestation, namely the organism. Now you look at it that way and you'll see how these ideas of rebirth and karma, as presented, most inadequately and misleadingly presented, they are nonsense. When what I say, what I call I, die, it's Firoz Mehta is completely dead. All the elements, what we call the material elements, body and so on, you see, as well as the immaterial, soul, spirit, call it what you like, the transcendent elements, they are all just themselves again. In toto, in totality. You know, when one really sees that, one is absolutely free of the fear of death and the fear of what will be the hereafter. I can tell you that from my own experience. There's no need for fearing death. There is no need to be anxious about the future. Just live the good life to the best of your ability, and that is all that matters. And of course, the hundreds of millions of us will not ever succeed in realizing that transcendent state. It doesn't matter. Transcendence doesn't care about that, because it is transcendence. The totality is the totality. It can never be less, it can never be more. You see? And when the particular, the separate from the totality, realizes that, there is a wonderful freedom and a peace inside. And a happiness which is utterly with other, it has no sensation in it. It's beyond sensation. And when it is beyond sensation, it is beyond all the limitations imposed upon us by the functioning of our senses and the interpretation by the brain, using language as its tool. You know, really see this. I've said it 1,000 times, I think, during these years. Don't believe a word of what I say. Consider it. Let what I say, or let what I have written, just be quietly in your mind. You see? And in the meditative state, you will find enlightenment, and you will be free of anxiety, free of fear. Trouble will come because we live in a world which is full of trouble. The world is our house. Is the house in which we live. And there's always dust and dirt and trouble and breakages and repairs to be done and so forth in the house, with the house, isn't it? That is all. It's like that. But if we have the vision, sufficient vision, we shall have the sufficient strength, inward strength, to take in our stride everything that happens. It could be very, very painful and sorrowful. True. That's the matter. I know people would say, oh, it's all very well for you to talk like that. You're all right and so forth. Supposing. Well, don't suppose. A supposition is a barb, the Buddha said. Now, when we are reduced to our nothingness, the transcendent is there. In this experiencing of the infinite, we are unself-conscious, meaning not self-conscious, but conscious in terms of totality. We do not know God, but God knows us. Now, remember that the word know in this sentence has two quite different meanings. Our knowing is all in terms of bits and pieces. That's a piano. Those are books, you see. This is a house. That is Guy. That is Stephen. And so on, you see, in bits and pieces. That is how we know. And that is the only way in which we know God. Read the descriptions which are ascribed to God in all the scriptures of the world. What are they? Potty little, absolutely petty little descriptions. It's just one's own self apotheosized. You can't find a single term attributed to God which is not also in yourself. But we are limited and restricted and confined, you see. God is the unconfined, the unrestricted. The context of the transcendent is the infinite and the eternal, which negates all our finitude and temporality. Now, we cannot know God, for our kind of knowing is incapable of grasping the infinite. The knowing by the infinite of us is other than what we can mentally perceive. That's what I've been trying to present now. The beloved who truly gives herself to love swoons. The lover knows her. You know how in Genesis 4:1, the first verse in chapter 4 starts, and Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived. Of course, everybody translates that only in physical terms, you see. But there is a transcendent counterpart to that sort of statement. When I swoon, that is to say, I am struck dumb with the vision of transcendence, you see, and I swoon, then transcendence knows me. And that experience by this organism so impresses the organism that sooner or later there will emerge thought and word which expresses the reality a little less misleadingly, a little less inadequately. That's what happens. Recovering from the swoon, which is the unself-conscious state, a conception grows, for the natural tendency of the surface mind, the conscious verbalizer, is to set limits to the infinite and formulate a spatio-temporal experience out of the spaceless and timeless experiencing. The experiencing is spaceless and timeless, because in that experiencing, all consciousness of the finite and temporal is out. Strange are the results of such conceiving. Truly, experiencing the immeasurable is indescribable, the actual experiencing. The unknown, the infinite, cannot be crammed into the known and finite mold of speech-thought. I hyphenate the two words, speech-thought, for the very simple reason that all thought is just inaudible speech. You see, the activity of the discursive mind right through our lives is a speech activity. I stumbled upon this long, long ago, around about 1952. That's it, you see. And I was delighted to find in the Buddhist texts, Dhammadinna, I think it is, the nun who explains to another person who asks questions about all this, and she says that discursive thought is speech. Well, you try and think without words. I know people, Sylvia is one of them, She says, oh, but I can think in pictures. Can you? How do you recognize your picture? Excepting by a name, by a word. You see, the word is paramount. Speech is of tremendous power. Thinking, speaking about the transcendent only forges mental images of the imageless. A game of make-believe like the fantasy play of an imaginative child. The living experiencing is truth in the religious sense. It is the real knowing of God. The images made by the mind, the verbal formulations set down in a book, even in holy writ, however stimulating or inspiring, are but the expressions of conceiving and bringing forth, excrescences of the ineffable reality. They are but a tomb of the truth. Man, the living immortal, must rise out of this tomb, leaving in it merely a bundle of clothes, an astonishment to the unawakened. You know they say about Jesus that when the two Marys went, they found only a bundle of clothes and not the living Jesus. The living body was not there. You see? So, putting it in terms of the deeper vision of things, we have the vision of the truth, and in that vision of the truth enables the living immortal, which is not me, the separate me, which is transcendence itself, that can rise out of the tomb, leaving only the expressions made, the expressions in thought and speech and action in the world by the psychophysical organism, which was called Jesus. The clothes are just that, his teachings. Form, nevertheless, must not be despised. It's because all thought and speech is formulating that which is the unformulatable. Its very limitations are the goads that move us to transcendence. Thought itself can serve the purpose of laying bare the fact that all images, and thought only makes images, mental images, it lays bare the fact that all images are but idols. And speech itself can sound the alarm that deflects us from the rape of truth. If thought speech be pure, the human dialogue can lift our eyes to the stars. Then, if it is possible to empty the mind of all its images, its illusions and delusions, the divine dialogue can take place. Because the emptied mind, spacious and silent, does not hinder the experiencing of the transcendent. See, if and when you practice meditation and you succeed in entering into any sort of deep state, really deep state, you see, you will find that the brain has stopped talking. It is emptied. When the mind is emptied of all its beliefs, its convictions, its certainties, and so forth, because All beliefs, convictions and so on are born of experience in the context of the finite and the temporal, which is the context of the mortal, the dying. You see? And then you suddenly wake up to this fact that, oh, all that I thought was nothing. You know, I have said this in past meetings too. Thomas Aquinas wrote 12 volumes of his marvelous work, the Summa Theologica. When he came to the 13th volume, he stopped writing, because it was at that time that he actually had the experience of the divine, the actual experiencing. And one day, when an intimate friend was talking with him, discussing why he didn't go on and so on, he said, "All that I have written is rubbish, where the truth is concerned." It's very, very significant. This unclouded vision is shapeless and formless. It has no limited expression, therefore. It is not finite. After the unself-conscious experiencing, in which the total mind was wholly silent, then when you come out of that experiencing, because you have to come out of it ultimately, you have to eat, you have to drink, you have to eliminate, you have to assimilate, and all that sort of, the bodily process has to go on. The mind was wholly silent. After you come out of it, the surface mind, that is to say the activity of the brain, starts up again. The surface mind again sets up the self-conscious experiencer. You again become conscious as I, John Smith. The verbalizing faculty intrudes upon the beatitude of silence. Finite images of the imageless infinite materialize the unclouded vision. And thus the word of Scripture comes into being. The act of conceiving and the act of verbalizing must be as pure as possible. What sullies the purity is our conditioning, the conditioning of the psychophysical organism through two main influences: natural evolution for over 1,000 millennia, and the cultural conditioning by the particular society in which we are born and bred and educated. See, there are these two influences. The body has come in, we as we are, have come into being as a process, as an evolutionary process. And the structure of our brain particularly, you see, bears the imprint of this tremendous 600 million year evolution. There is the brain stem, which of course starts right from the beginning with the animal kingdom. Now the brain stem is the apparatus through which the energies which control our breathing, heartbeat, respiration, and all the rest of it, you see, it deals with just bodily living. And that is surrounded, the brain stem here is surrounded by the what they call the R complex, which bears the imprint of the reptilian stage through which the brain went. And that was responsible for fear. That is the apparatus which expresses fear, aggression, hierarchical situations, and so forth and so forth. You see, territory. This is my territory. And it will fight another animal who intrudes upon his territory. And then after that, perhaps about 100 million years after that, the reptiles existed around about 600 million years ago, came the mammals. Now, an immense difference came into the world with the evolution of the mammals. The mammals gave birth to live young. The reptiles laid eggs. You see? The mammals gave birth to live young. And with the evolution of the mammals, the caring for the young, which was the root source of love between creature and creature, gradually came into existence. And the peak development of the mammals took place with the primates, the whole monkey group, and particularly the gorilla and the chimpanzee, the orangutan and the lemur, you see. And so we have the brain stem, the reptilian brain, the mammalian brain, and then the cortex began to develop. And it was only about 3.5 million years ago that this primate began to stand upright and walk in Africa, you see. And it was it took a long time for the cortex to grow, and the cortex, which is responsible for all that we know culturally, lived in uneasy truce with the mammalian reptilian part of the brain, you see. Slowly, values and so on came into being. The mammalian part of the brain played a great role in developing happy relationships, harmony, and so forth and so forth. And it was only about 40,000 years ago, or 45,000 years ago, after the Neanderthals, that man constituted today as he is came into being. So our present, you see, the constitution, the apparatus for transcendence has to become better and better. It's like our ordinary everyday life. We invent something which is a better instrument for the same purpose. So, in 40,000 years, we have come to this stage culturally because of the increased sensitivity, the increased refinement, and the increased receptivity to impressions has grown in the organism. And it has happened side by side with the development of what we call psyche and mind. You know, I have separated the two very much. The way I have presented it is better than the old way. Mind, I call that archetypal expression of the primordial creative energy, which is the formative influence in the whole of the evolutionary process. That is what mind is. It is universal. It is not particular. It is not my property or your property. I have no mind. Just, I might as well say, I have all space or all eternity. I don't have anything of the sort, you see. So mind is that. Now, the manifestation of mind, this formative influence, and it is the source of what we call intelligence. Mind is a transcendent thing. Mind interacting with the apparatus, the organism, and especially the brain and nervous system, the ductless glands and so on, gives rise to our psyche. And it is the psyche which is composed of our mental, intellectual, emotional life and functioning, you see. That's our psyche. And it is the psyche which has flaws in it, simply because that transcendent energy which has to use the brain as its instrument, has to use an instrument which has rather troublesome aspects, the reptilian and the undeveloped mammalian and so forth, you see. So this is how the whole story of our conflicts and sorrow and difficulty and problems and all the rest of it has come into being. We must really understand this. Mind you, what I am saying, after all, is a very surface thing, superficial. I don't know much about all these things. But that's why the study of science is extremely important. Extremely important. Because it gives us some sort of vision into how and why things happen as they do happen. The apparatus is faulty. If, for example, a bulb, an electric bulb, is faulty, when the current comes on, it is liable to burst, isn't it? It's like that. So, and in our case, the psychophysical organism is liable to disease, decay, and death. Now, the great teachers were those who, to the highest degree possible in their circumstances, do remember that, had grown free of their conditioning. We have false pictures of the teachers. We make an imaginary picture of impossible perfection for every one of them. That's not true. We make this picture about them. They were perfect in relation, relatively to us, where their understanding of us human beings was concerned. They understood the psyche completely. They were omniscient with respect to the psyche and psychical functioning, but not very much more. Look at the things the Buddha said, trying to explain earthquakes, for instance, and things like that. And both the Buddha and Jesus were hopelessly wrong in some of the predictions they made about the future. Hopelessly out, you see. If they were omniscient in the supreme sense, any of the spiritual teachers were omniscient in the supreme sense, they could easily, as human organisms, have predicted accurately the whole history of the human race and its development. But they couldn't. They didn't. They made suggestions. And some of those suggestions are wonderful, really. As a matter of fact, in this book, you will find either in the chapter on mindfulness or the previous chapter, that is to say the 20th or the 19th chapter, you will find a quotation from the Vishnu Purana and from the New Testament where they say that human beings will be like this, that and the other in the periods to come. And they were not far wrong. But they weren't able to tell us very much.